Thank you, Hans.
Raghava.
Good afternoon. So at the previous board meeting, we were asked to analyze a couple of things. First, what more work would be required on the relatively straightforward improvements, which includes the removing restriction on future restructuring and performance enhancement cash flows, the pre-tax, post-tax issue, and the possible additional disclosures. So what additional work would be required on those three things to be able to proceed straight with, let's say, proposing amendments to the relevant standards? And the other thing we were also asked to analyze was the pros and cons of proceeding straight with a request for information targeted at seeking feedback on the headroom approach. So the first thing on the relatively straightforward improvements, in paragraphs 13 to 36 of the paper, we've analyzed and identified what work is needed on those three approaches that the board tentatively decided to consider to pursue. So for convenience, I would suggest that we take one question after the other. So first, what I would ask you is, in relation to removing restriction that excludes specified cash flows, do you agree with the staff recommendation that including a more likely than not condition in relation to the cash flows from future restructuring and future performance enhancement would sort of address the concerns that we had in preventing any unwarranted management optimism creeping into value in use calculation?
I would actually like to make some comments about the proposals as a whole and where we are with this project as a whole. So, but I don't necessarily need the whole introduction.
Sure. Okay. But could we take those comments when we move to the second question?
Well, I'm not ready to vote for that first question in an isolation of,
okay,
of the.
Okay. Sure.
Because when I look at the staff's recommendations, which are a logical outflow of what we asked the staff to do, I've been doing a lot of rethinking of the whole project, and I just don't think we ended in the right place. I think doing further work on this headroom approach, while I think most of us have absolutely no illusion that we will be able to generate sufficient support for that approach, I really wonder what are we doing then. And those minor improvements we can talk about later, but they are minor, and I'm not sure if they are in themselves sufficient to progress as at this point. We have said throughout the project, most of the board at least, we did not receive new information that leads us to reconsider, for example, amortization of goodwill. Now, I think rethinking the whole project, that it has led to, for me at least, three new pieces of information. First of all, the work on the headroom approach was extremely useful and has made clearer than before, although even the previous board that took the decision to not amortize goodwill, they knew that this headroom would be a hindrance for impairment. But I think it is clearer than ever before that impairment is likely to be flawed because of this this problem, because of the shielding effect. Also, even with those minor improvements, we have not been able to address the impairment issue in a cost-effective way. We have not been able to come up with solutions that make it either less costly or more effective. We have not been able to do so. And I think that in this respect, it's very good to have in mind, to keep in mind, that the previous board who took all these decisions, most of them saw goodwill potentially as a wasting asset and therefore relied on the impairment test to deal with it if it was impaired. And I think now that we, knowing what we know now, I think that we know that the impairment test is intrinsically flawed. And then, so that is also new information for me. And then the third new piece of information that came actually from outside this project, when we had that fantastic presentation by Professor Sloan from Berkeley a couple of weeks ago, in which he made very clear to us that there are a lot of investors there who work with what we would probably consider primitive formulas, but in which book value plays a big role. And we always assume investors take it all out, they adjust for goodwill, not important. Well, there are a lot of people there out there that for whom it is important, who take it at face value, and so book value matters more than we probably think. And I recently received a presentation from Japan where it was also shown that the Quonso, exactly the people who work with robotics and digital financial information, they also use book to value as a primitive indicator for investment. So in the light of these three issues, I think it's not really acceptable that we have such a big and persistent difference in the balance sheet between organically growing companies and companies that grow by acquisition, because that's what you get. There's no correction for it at any point. And I also think it is not good that we are stuck with an impairment test which is both ineffective and also flawed. And expensive. And then finally, I really think that there is a potential reputational risk for the IASB here. We all know that the markets right now are very high. They are fueled by leverage across the system. Corporates have never been so leveraged before in history. And I am absolutely sure there is going to be a massive reaction, correction of the market at a certain point. And a lot of companies will be caught with their pants down with huge amounts of goodwill on their balance sheets, which they might then have to write off in at once. And a lot of people will say, where was the IASB? Because you see all these dodgy assets sitting on the balance sheet. So that is something that makes me nervous, and it reminds me very much of the post-financial crisis discussions that we've had about prudence and about expected losses, etc. This is one's waiting to happen, where we will be, where with a superficial reasoning, the board could be accused of, you know, allowing balance sheets to be inflated because of flawed impairment of goodwill. So all that, you know, makes me feel very uncomfortable with just ending this as we are threatening to do. So I think that if we were going to go for a DP, that at least that we have to acknowledge that this is a very unsatisfactory situation, and that we'll have some problems there. You could still argue, if you in a DP, if you want to argue some, propose some alternatives, you could still say, well, we have no alternative. We know it's flawed, but there's no better impairment is also, or amortization is also flawed. We don't see there. There's a big advantage in that, so let's just live with what we have. That you could still say that, but I think that that we should seriously sketch the alternative of impairment, and possibly one of the. I think it will always be impossible to come up with a reasonable underpinning for building off impairment for the amortization. Sorry, for amortization. So you could think of a fixed period for all 10 years. I don't know, in which at least that issue has been not solved but recognized. I could also think about rethinking write-off in day one, but both amortization and write-off would take a lot of pressure of the impairment exercise, the yearly impairment exercise, and costliness of the system and could also would give us more room to take more cost out of impairment, because we wouldn't have to be so worried about the impairment becoming less effective. And if we take cost out that way, perhaps then we could increase disclosure requirements, which might be more costly, which we are now very hesitating to do because of the existing cost in the system. But then we could say, well, we've reduced cost in, on the one hand, and let's try to get some meaningful disclosures in instead. And that's something I think we could think of. I don't think that the if we were going to go this way, I still don't think that the headroom approach should be one of the options, because I don't think it's going to fly. But it could. The whole analysis has been extremely useful and could be used in a discussion paper. Yeah, and in the meantime, what it has also become clear to me is that current presentation of goodwill is very. On the balance sheet is very varied, and a lot of companies submerge it in intangibles and don't make an a clear difference between other intangibles and goodwill. And I think that is also very unsatisfactory. So I think the least that we should do, and perhaps we could do that quickly perhaps even in the better communication project. Make goodwill much more visible. I would also, as a sort of a reality check for investors, I think it would be very useful for companies to show what their equity would be like without goodwill. So sort of a tangible equity line. Could do that in the notes, I don't know. But I think that could be useful. Some of the companies that have recently come under a lot of pressure, if you took out goodwill, they would have had negative equity. And I am absolutely sure that a lot of investors, not the sophisticated ones, but the unsophisticated ones, were not aware of that. And I think it is, given the fluffiness of goodwill, I think that is something that investors should be aware of. So these are the thoughts I have at this moment. I really think that where we landed, that it is not satisfactory, and I think we have to think further.
Okay, so
it's always very dangerous when the chairman thinks too much about an issue. Anne?
Hans, thanks for giving us that summary. I think you've summarised a lot of concerns. I know myself and many others have been concerned as we've gone along. We've had great work from the staff, but it's been very hard to do what we wanted to do as a result of the PIR, which was to improve the effectiveness and also reduce costs. So I have spoken with others, and I know that I've been concerned about the what we're proposing to do, leaving aside headroom for the moment, which there have been a lot of concerns about. Even the other things have been very small changes. So in the package we have now, it's hard to see how that addresses what are very big problems, and you've outlined big problems. So I think that your comments are helpful for us to open the discussion now about other ways we might proceed, rather than continuing with the excellent work that the team have given us, but they've taken us to one particular place. And myself, I'm not happy that that's enough of a response, both to the PIR, but both to the situation in which we find ourselves.
Daryl?
So I think if we are going to think about taking a different direction, in your discussion, you were bringing up a couple of different rationales for where we might do it. I think the outcome of those different rationales would depend very much on the objective that we, or, well, the rationales themselves would set the objective we're looking at. So if, for example, we're going to argue that the rationale is to achieve similar accounting for acquisition-orientated entities and organic entities, then that suggests no goodwill at all. And I think it would be critical for us, if we're going to step back and think about this project anew, to think about, first instance, what we think it is that we're trying to achieve. The amortization of goodwill has gone down a route that's been explored in a lot of detail. And so I think putting aside what you said on that, but my starting point often on this is to think, well, if we really want to get that comparison between the two types of entity, then day one write-off of goodwill may be the answer that makes the most sense. But I think it starts out by saying, what do we think we want to achieve? We started out with this project saying we wanted to simply tweak what we could and leave the remainder. And I think there's some really good ideas in terms of the disclosure requirements, in terms of understanding what users want out of the goodwill analysis, like the success of the acquisition. But if we are going to deliberately now, we're going to specifically step back from it, I think we need to have a very clear objective, first and foremost, in mind of what it is we're trying to achieve.
Doc?
Thank you. talked about the the function of PIR. I think to think about the function of the PIR is very important. My takeaway of purpose of the PIR is to check whether the standard is working as we intended. And then the in these 10 years, what did we find? So some people say there is no new evidence to change our standard. However, as Hans articulated, I think there are lots of issues came out. Therefore, I think it's high time for us to reconsider a little bit more significantly. So therefore, in response to staff's question, I think we should go to the discussion paper, including a little more ideas, not only just small tweak of our IS 36, but also including reintroduction of amortization or other presentation in the notes or balance sheet. So those kind of things must be reconsidered seriously. And on top of the fact finding Hans pointed out, I think the biggest find out is more aggressive attitude of the entities. If you compare the capital market, current capital market to the capital market in 10 years, the size of acquisition is getting bigger and bigger. It's not really comparable. And the people are getting more aggressive with having a huge amount of headroom in their balance sheet. So I was keep saying that it gave us kind of a procyclicality mechanism. So if you have a good acquisition, namely good acquisition for the moment, then you can earn quite a lot of profit. Then that gives a large future cash flow that would create more market value. Then they have more headroom. Then they can make another acquisition quite easily because they know that new acquisition wouldn't cause any impairment because they have a huge headroom. So then definitely we know that our impairment test has a significant flaw. And we knew that flaw when we made this IS 36 10 years ago. However, at that time, there was no empirical evidence because we don't know what kind of behavior a company will take. But in this 10 years, what happened was company get more aggressive and more aggressive. Fortunately, we don't have any significant financial crisis yet. However, once we had a huge financial crisis, the flow of the mechanism would be significant procyclicality for the direction of that crisis. So therefore, I think it is a high time to do something now, relatively urgently. So I think we have to provide a good discussion paper as early as possible, and also, if possible, if we could provide some improvement to disclosure, as Hans pointed out, like showing the negative goodwill, negative equity, equity deducted by the goodwill amount could provide some information. Of course, information are already in the financial statements, and the change of the proposal could be very small. However, just asking to deduct may provide much good prominence of what could be the hypothetical problem. Thank you.
Sue? So in terms of where we are and what I think we should focus on, and I think Darrell raised a good point, we'd need to work out what it is we think we're solving for. I think for me, I think we should still be focusing on what it is that we heard from the post-implementation review and focusing on trying to address that. And those two main things were problems with timeliness and with costs. Now, what I would completely agree with Hans on is I think for me, I feel like I've got new information, which is as a consequence of the work that you guys have done on the headroom approach, because when we first started out, lots of people seemed to say there was a timeliness problem, but I wasn't sure I had the evidence to support that, because I can't tell if I look at market information whether people have just done lots of acquisitions and they've got goodwill that should be, you know, rightly still recognised because there is no impairment, or whether there's a timeliness problem. I think that's very hard to unpick. But what you have convinced me of in the analysis that we've done is that we sort of have a structural problem in the way that the mechanics work that seem to sort of stack the odds against recognising impairment even when it happens. And that for me is a really significant new piece of information that we need to share with people, along with the information which we've learned recently on how people consume information. But I think I'd still try and focus on the timeliness issue and the cost issue. Now, I think the challenge that we've got, and I share a bit of Hans's concern here on the timeliness, is if I look at the package that we've got, I think partly because we, and when I say we, I mean the board more than the staff, haven't done the best job in the world of selling the headroom approach. We've sort of poisoned our well, if you like, and it's left us with no good response that I can see to our timeliness issue, which means I think we probably need to circle back as a board to look at the amortisation arguments again and have a more comprehensive picture in the discussion paper about what some of the different approaches might be to try and address that. We could talk about the path we've been down with the headroom approach, because it helps people understand why we might be thinking differently about timeliness than we did before. But also some of the presentation options that Hans was talking about, and, you know, looking at amortisation again and raising it. I'm not sure that on balance, for me, there's still enough evidence to move all of the way to amortisation, but I think it's fair to ask others whether they agree. But where I think we probably need to do some more work and analysis before I feel I'd be in a position, or we would be in a position, to put a document out to the world is, what is the disclosure package? Because I think that, for me, that's the key. No matter who you talk to on the investor side and what their views are on amortisation or impairment, they all say we need better information to understand what's behind the numbers on acquisitions and to sort of take our views on impairment going forward. And if we can come up with a better disclosure package, I think maybe we can put some more discipline into the process of impairment from management's perspective, and arm investors with the information they need to question the impairment judgments and to make their own assessments. So we sort of can address the timeliness slightly more indirectly, but that way. But I think we'd need to do some more work on that. And the final thing I say is that I think also for me, my strong preference would be that we go out with our package of things that we're thinking about. I don't think we do ourselves or our stakeholders a service if we go out with, you know, these bits are a bit easier, so let's do these first, let's do these later, because we need more time. Because I think we need to be able to look holistically at what's the overall package, how does this respond to what we heard in the PIR, and how does it stack up from a cost-benefit perspective if I look at the whole set of proposals together. And I don't really see the benefit in rushing forward and tweaking, you know, discount rates and things like that in isolation and then later on doing other stuff. I think it's better brought as one thing.
Martin?
I agree what Hans has said, because I also think that the post-implementation review, the most important issue was, okay, the impairment test is not effective, so where we have impairments is too not timely. And there was a disclosure. People, investors don't have information, is an acquisition successful? I think the problem which we have is we're mixing both things up. Because because we think, okay, kind of measuring goodwill should be then make investors able to get information if an acquisition is successful, yes or no. And I think this linkage, I don't see that. And that is, my, from my perspective, the wrong conclusion. I think when we do this project and have a few new look on that, I think we should, as Daryl said, what is really the problem we want to solve? I think if the problem is really that we think, okay, that we have goodwill on the balance sheet, which is really a wasting kind of asset, which we should not have for so long time, then we should solve that problem. If we think, okay, that investors don't have sufficient information about how successful an acquisition is, that could be solved by disclosure. But if we're mixing all these kind of things up, then we have trouble. Because then we're mixing all the discussions, okay, information value of amortization or impairment. Now, clearly impairment has more information value than amortization, but both have little.
Yeah.
That is, I think, the problem. And therefore, I think to solve this problem about is an acquisition successful, we can address with disclosure maybe. But if we really, our big problem is, okay, and I agree with Han, that can be a big reputational problem that we still have assets on balance sheet which are should not be there because they are wasting assets. And it is not only, I think, in my life, it is not only financial information, not only for sophisticated users like analysts and sophisticated investors. It is also like politicians looking at that in a crisis, journalists looking at that, and they are not so sophisticated. And they don't excluding goodwill and goodwill impairment. They live with these numbers. And that is important, and important for us to consider. And if we don't consider that, if the crisis happened, it is a big reputation risk for us.
I agree with Martin, but I think there could be, and I tried to sketch that in my introduction, there could be a connection between dealing with the impairment issue through, for example, write-off organization, taking the pressure off, that also creates more room for cost relief. And that would create cost relief that you can almost shift to better information for investors through this more expensive disclosures. So I think you don't necessarily have to focus on just one of the two problems. I think you can do both. Nick.
Thank you. And I understand the concerns that Hans has expressed and the extent to which certain investors take headline metrics at face value these days. Equally, I appreciate what Martin has said. I think irrespective of how these are funded, these extra disclosures, I think sometimes we get in a muddle by mixing them together, and they are addressing separate issues. So whether goodwill is amortized, impaired, or written off, it doesn't change the economics of the transaction. The consideration will always be the same. And I think that goes back to the way investors' concerns are. And I think we can build on the work the team have already done around disclosures to have a more comprehensive set of disclosures. And so I'd like to spend some more time there. And I'd also support what Sue suggested, that we need a package here. Going out with pieces in isolation won't particularly help us. I think it's the whole which we need.
Mary?
Four things to note, and I'll start with the last one and pile on to the point about I want to keep it together rather than doing it in bits and pieces. Even if we don't see a high degree of interaction or interdependency between the very narrow simplifications and some of the other things, I think we perpetuate the perception that we work on things for a very long time. It's like which of the 17 versions of VIAS 36 are you applying, et cetera. And I don't see that they are so pressing to get those improvements that we should overcome those problems and address them separately. So I'm very much for putting together a DP. The second thing I'd say is I think this echoes something of what Hans said. I think we should turn the headroom discussion on its head, and say, having done this work, let's articulate first what we have learned about impairment and the impairment calculation. We learned it by trying to do things to solve it, but let's start out by saying what we've learned, and that makes us send the message first about the built-in shielding and some of the, you know, some of the challenges that are there. We could then go on to say that the only thing that we've, you know, been able to identify as a possible approach is the headroom approach. Here are the reasons why, if we decide that we're not going to pursue it to consult further, we haven't. But saying, but the headline message is what we've learned about the thing, rather than getting people to work their way through the solution and infer the challenges. The third, and this picks up on something else Hans said about his better understanding of how different kinds of users use the data, and that there's a large population that is relying on the book value number as an important metric. I agree with that. I don't want to dismiss it, but I heard that same message, but the context was really important for me, which said that ultimately I'm going to look at Nick to see if I got my learnings right. The fundamental analysis and investors are the ones who cause the markets to really true up to the inherent value. Those who focus on more quantitative kind of, I'll call it AI, although it really isn't that, you know, artificial intelligence, screening, processing large pieces of large pools of data that rely on reported metrics like book value, are screening to identify anomalies that they can get in and take advantage of the anomaly before there's that correction. So the reliance of users on metrics is...
No, that's not what he said.
No, it is. He was saying that they are trying to identify the ones where ultimately they expect correction based on fundamental analysis, but it's an input into a screening across lots... why you can look at 2,000 companies in their metrics when you couldn't do fundamental analysis of those 2,000 in the same period of time.
I mean, I think it's right. These funds have very diverse portfolios. So actually, the pricing ultimately is set by the analytical, by the fundamental investor taking the numbers to pieces. They own 2,000, 3,000 stocks.
Of course, right. the good fundamental investors ultimately drive the market.
Yeah.
But in the meantime, a lot of people invest in these funds that are governed by robots.
Right. Yeah? And
faulty algorithms that use
books. Well, crude rather than faulty. And what I'm, you know, it's the joke about in the end, we're all dead. In the end, the fundamental analysts are proven right with the prices, and we have to worry about the time before before it comes out as well. So I agree with you on that. But I think we have to remember to feed the fundamental analysts, as well as taking into consideration the users who rely on simpler metrics like book value. So that's three things. So want to do a whole package rather than pieces. Let's articulate the learning of the headroom. Let's remember to feed both kinds of users, not just one kind, but let's not forget about either of them. But the fourth is a question that struck me, particularly as I was reading paper 18 about the disclosures. And I think it's better explored in a discussion paper. But I think we need answers to it, which is, what is our intention in terms of the responsibility of preparers with respect to goodwill? Hi, philosophical and highfalutin. What I mean is usually if you have an asset recognized, it's an identifiable item, and you have to basically demonstrate the recoverability of the cost of that item. And I think we are unclear in the literature about whether the preparer's responsibility is to demonstrate the recoverability of that item, the goodwill on transaction X, or whether the responsibility is that there's a cost pool that doesn't really relate to anything. It's just a number. And that all you have to do is demonstrate, and I'm talking in our current context, the recoverability of X cost. If it's recoverability of X cost, then all the arguments about it's really hard to do anything that holds you to account because it gets integrated and changed is, they're valid arguments. But if the world thinks that preparers, the acquirers, should be held accountable for transaction X versus transaction Y, and the goodwill that comes from transaction X, then I think it's fairer to impose a burden that says it may be hard, but you have to figure out a way to demonstrate that that transaction X goodwill is still valid, as opposed to the cost of that got thrown into a pool and you just have to prove the pool. And I haven't articulated it that well, but I think we have to ask that question kind of back to Daryl's challenge about what problem are we trying to solve. If we know which version of goodwill we're trying to deal with, then I think we take very different approaches to what is a reasonable expectation, you know, in terms of recoverability and demonstrating recoverability. So all this leads me back to saying, I think we should do a discussion paper. I think we should capture our learnings in maybe a different way. And it may be a discussion paper with fewer preliminary views about we should do X, as opposed to do you agree we should try to address this, and if so, on what, you know, which basis.
Gary?
Thank you. In general, Hans, I think I agree with most of the points you made, and we build on a few and give some from my experience, largely from the other side, but since it's largely a converged standard, I think, and I think this, the ISB followed the other side by a year or two, so I think some of the points, at least they're relevant in our world over here. First of all, thinking of how did we get here? First of all, but we got here because they want to get rid of pooling. I mean, impairment had always been around, but you also had amortization, and amortization very quickly, if you had anything approaching the right amortization period, very quickly got you beyond impairment. But it had been around, sort of primitive by the way the standards of today and the evolution of the concept, but it had been around. I think the thought was, well, it's been around, we should probably don't make it work. But then everything went into goodwill, but then people got nervous about it's too big of a non-amortizing asset, so we came up with amortizing intangibles or indefinite lived intangibles to take goodwill down by a bit. I mean, that was sort of the dialogue and the discussions and the puts and takes. You know, would, absent getting rid of pooling, would we have ever gotten to an impairment on Molly? Yes. I can look back today and say probably not, but I don't know what they would have thought at the time if the question was there. But that's sort of the history of how we got here. And I don't think in the debate, keep amortization versus impairment was relatively close, and deep emotions and rational arguments on both sides of it. But it wasn't like impairment won 90 to 10, you know, in the election, if you will. It was close. But what did we learn about impairment since then? I've heard we didn't learn any more arguments about reintroducing amortization. Well, I think we did. The argument we heard is impairment didn't work. They thought it would, but it didn't, you know, for the reasons this project exists. In fact, might even be harder, than originally was envisioned, you know, many years ago, you know, as this thought developed. I think the difficulty in applying the model today, it's not looking at projections of revenue or profit or cash to compare against a current value that's done. It's the issue is in the CGU, and if you had an acquisition and it stayed intact and perhaps was its own operating segment, I think life would be easier. But the minute it starts getting merged into operations, the problem is it doesn't stay intact. And so revenues go one place, costs get captured, goodwill tends to stay where it was, and it gets flawed by virtue of just in movement, you know, inside a company that just happens, you know, daily, monthly, annually. So we never figured out a way to keep goodwill and the operations or the that came along with it together to measure. And we're never gonna be able to solve that. If we went out with a DP on the subject, which I happen to support, and I agree it's not just perhaps arguing for amortization. I think the argument for amortization is, in part, because we might not have a better way consistently done. But I think you got to put more thoughts in there, too. Decided I got the level zero approach. You know, we did not really. I mean, that's a valid. It's work. It's used in 70% of the major companies. Over there, the level zero, that's the indicators only approach. We did not spend much time on it. But if we're going to have a fulsome discussion on what do you do about it, that's widely used. Mm-hmm. Should we explore when acquisition is fully integrated into the company as a whole, at what point should goodwill be tested at the parent company level as opposed to an operating segment level? These are valid arguments, I think, that need to be explored if we're going to go a DP route. I think I wouldn't object to an ED for the minor projects the staff has recommended. I wouldn't lay in the tracks arguing we should do it, but I certainly wouldn't object to it. And lastly, I think on the presentation of goodwill against equity and stuff, I think that probably does belong perhaps in the primary financial statements project. But I don't see it as mutually exclusive from this. I think you could do both. You know, we could put in that project, test if that's the way to present your primaries, regardless of how it's measured, and this project deals with the measurement of it, either day one or subsequent measurement. So I think they can both coexist if we want them to.
That was also my idea. Françoise?
Well, my first observation is that if we believe that we are facing a reputation risk for not having the right presentation, that's something that we should address. But I don't think you respond to reputation risk by embarking in a project of 6 years or so before you deliver to the market appropriate solutions. So to me, there is a real gap between let's take this reputation risk into account and let's move, and the response being let's move to a discussion paper that in fact reopens all the issues. I have a difficulty reconciling the two together. The second point is that I don't think that we have really faced the market with the updated headroom approach. I don't think we have done that. And it's true that because we entertain regular outreach contacts, we have broached on the subject more than anything else. We have done that in two steps. First, the headroom approach, then the updated headroom approach, without having or even having evidence that, in fact, the input we were receiving was not necessarily in response to what was really eventually on the table. And when we've done that, I think if we have received such negative first reactions, and I insist on the first reaction, it's in a way because we have stepped into the arena of forward-looking disclosures. Because attached to the updated item approach, you have the disclosure of the recoverable amounts. And that is forward-looking disclosures. That's disclosures that users would find extremely useful. Following them over time provides a lot of information, but you may have a very high resistance of preparers to deliver such forward-looking information within the financial statement and with that level of precision. So I think it's not unlikely that what is eventually would eventually prevent us to progress towards the updated headroom approach would in fact prevent us exactly in the same way of providing users with more relevant information. So it's not in taking the updated headroom approach aside that you all of a sudden have a full ground available to you to indeed provide users with the disclosures that they wish. So also I think it would be unheard in the ISB history to just out of a round of outreach context to refrain from promoting a solution that has the potential of getting to better accounting just after just a round of approval. I mean, don't want to take other examples when that didn't happen, and probably for the good. So all of us, and I also in favor of keeping things as packaged as possible, because I think it's less costly to implement. It's easier on educational and implementation grounds. It's easier for users to grasp the changes all at once. So, all in all, I'm not. I mean, I remain very unsympathetic to the lengthy route of a full-blown open discussion paper, because I think we have to also have proportionate efforts in our consultation in order to exactly really focus on what we don't know that we need to know in order to move ahead and not reopen all the issues without any preliminary views. I mean, as if we were seeking information that, in fact, we have already received in the past implementation review.
Amaro?
Excellent. I think at this stage, just to stress a few points. First, in the previous discussion, I was of having an exposure draft and then an RFI to explore the details on the headroom. I do agree with others at this stage, as the discussion is going, having all in one package is better for us to conclude the project. So for only four points on the I do agree with stress what was stressed by Martin and Hans before. The PIR objectives were very clear to us, timeliness and cost. And I think we should stick to that. None of the solutions are perfect. I think everyone knows that. And that was even in stressed in the previous decision when amortization was abandoned in favor of impairment. We should remind ourselves that we didn't really hear anything new that made us feel strongly about abandoned impairment, and this to me is very important because we are not discussing IFRS 3. We are responding to the PIR. So if I didn't hear anything new, and even the empirical evidence that was brought to us didn't show anything new, why would we believe it's necessary to go back and rediscuss again amortization versus impairment? There are flaws. Yes, there are flaws. If we are going to the DP, I think two important aspects should be explored or clarified is one that was Gary posed, how we got here, why we are here, and the flaw that we identified or imperfections in both models and why we landed in the impairment only. I don't think we should entertain ourselves going back to amortization at this stage. I don't think we don't need more work or analysis on what we have so far. I would really prefer us acknowledging the flawless, our inability to really reduce the cost and provide more timely impairment, explore alternatives to disclosure, provide investors, as Nick stressed, the information they need to really assess how successful the transaction was. And I think this will be extremely helpful. I acknowledge that the work you did in the headroom approach, it was extremely valuable for us to understand what is that, how it could be used, and how eventually more complex it could be compared to the benefit that could be generated about using it. And I think the work you did is also helpful in identify issues that users should pay attention to and eventually could be captured in a disclosure type solution. If we're talking about reputation risk and the under the potential for significant or highly leveraged number companies around, so we should respond as quickly as possible. And so I would package everything, focus on disclosure in a DP, the sooner the better.
But I remember distinctly from the discussions that we had around disclosures that we were very cautious in imposing new disclosure requirements that were probably going to be very costly because we were totally impotent in reducing the cost of the system as a whole. So, you know, I do not think that we can go out with a DP that says, yeah, we know it's all flawed, but we cannot do too much about it. But as a, you know, as a an improvement, we suggest these disclosures. Yes, they are costly, but that's what investors want. I think that's not going to fly. Jambu?
Thank you. I agree with your suggestion, you know, kind of a separate presentation of Gudin from others and, you know, emphasize some kind of a negative equity if we exclude Gudin. You know, that kind of a approach might be very new, so it might be, you know, some kind of a feedback from the, our stakeholders, whether they would like to have a, you know, this kind of a presentation. So that would be a kind of an issue that can be dealt with on issues with the in discussion paper or RFI. So generally, I think that's a new idea. So we need some kind of feedback. Also, I'd like to answer on your specific questions. First one is a yes. Second one is a divide project, yes. And what is the specific approach? Is C or D? I prefer D. And the number three, action. Yeah, I would like to have both parallel in parallel. Fourth, discussion paper, or RFI, I prefer discussion paper. Mm-hmm. However, I would like to suggest one minor different idea. I guess the problem we are facing on is the amount of goodwill on the balance sheet. So as Mayor summarized very well. However, I don't know why Martin said these are two different problems we are facing on. I guess the disclosure improvements are suggested to say something on the amount of a good deal. Because if there is something, you know, that our impairment test is not so good, then this is kind of alternative way to show some information to investors to calculate whether this the amount of goodwill on balance is a right or wrong. So I thought that this whole package is a kind of focusing on one issue, the amount of goodwill on the balance. We are not dealing with any kind of success or not of this any acquisition. That's not our job. Professional accountant, we cannot provide such information. We are just considering the amount of the balance or income statement. So we are providing some kind of assurance whether it's reliable. Others, insurance to investors to search for the other information. That's what I thought that this project is, the problem is that this project having the project has happened this one. So I guess, the disclosure requirements, improvement of disclosure requirements that might be related to hetero approach or improvement to the impairment test. So I prefer, the package of the issues in the DP include the disclosure requirements improvements with the hetero approach and with some other special separate presentation of negative equity something. So this might be a good idea to get more concrete feedback from stakeholders.
Nick, you wanted to respond.
Yeah, thank you. So I think there are separate things. I don't think disclosures are just about the goodwill. In fact, I'd separate them. I do think we do have a duty to provide investors with information to understand whether this piece of capital allocation is going to deliver a good return or not. I think the problem with the goodwill number is that it represents a number of things. It may represent synergies. It may be unrecognized intangibles. It may be overpayment. From one company to another, we don't know what it represents. And actually, by taking a different approach, by looking at disclosures around the economics of the deal, users can start to dig around and make an assessment of whether it stacks up from a different perspective, I would say. So in that respect, that's why I would have them separate. Nor am I sure that certainly the ones I've looked at necessarily are that costly to provide. So I think we need to explore them before we give judgment on that.
Jan Chow?
Thank you, Hans. First of all, I also agree with Hans's concern, but we need to find a solution how to deal with those issues. I think from our accounting perspective, only three ways. One is recognition. Second is measurement. Third is disclosure. So if we look at those goodwill issues, as Tuck said, that recent years, a lot of merger acquisition quite aggressive. Whether at the first day, the acquisition date, those, you know, acquisition, those considered paid for acquired business, overpaid or not, and those overpaid amount should be recognized at goodwill or not. This is a recognition solution, but it seems that, yeah, it seems some goodwill actually arising from overpaid, not from the assets you really buy, the value of the assets you buy. But it seems that because this is the PIR project, during the PIR process, it seems that we didn't hear a lot concern with regard to this recognition of goodwill because of overpaid or something like that. So if not, I think I agree with Delo's point. We should focus on the message we got during the PIR about the timeliness and the cost. So maybe we should focus on measurement and disclosure. And the staff are work very hard to try how to improve the measurement, especially about the impairment methodology. So how to improve the future cash flow, forecast cash flow, and how to, if we're introducing update headroom. Originally, I have a lot of concern about updated headroom approach, but now I think it's worth to explore to further and to seek the feedback, those improved methodology works or not. If it doesn't work, I think at this moment we should explore the disclosure approach. As Sue and Nick said, I think if we provide better disclosure, you know, solution to give discipline, especially because investors don't know you how valuable those acquired business, and the management know that, and how after the acquisition date, how you manage those business, and I think this kind of information management know, there is some, and the investor don't know. So if disclose this kind of relevant information, I think maybe can improve the measurement of the goodwill or of the impairment of the goodwill. So, and I also agree that, as Sue said, that I hope that the future consultation paper should be a whole package of all those topics. Not separated. Yeah.
Mary?
Two thoughts. One is, turns out, echoing something Nick said about disclosures. Just going back and checking in this paper, I think the messages we heard about the disclosures are, one, the difficulty, and not necessarily cost, but it was the traceability issues. So it wasn't that it's high cost, you have to collect a lot more data or do a lot more calculations, and even more so the commercial sensitivity of the information we were asking people to be transparent about. So that isn't cost, at least in the cash outflows, sense. It's how much accountability in information. It's a different kind of cost, but it isn't the kind of complexized 36 having to get specialist advisors. But the other thinking in part about marrying Jing Zhao's comments with Daryl's before, I know, Raghava, that you have a very good summary on a couple of slides that says, here are the kind of, I think it's five messages from the PIR where we decided to do research. And maybe the first step of anything is saying, here are the five things we identified in the PIR on which we decided to do research. This isn't a continuation of the PIR. These are the findings that we had from that. We decided to research to see if we should do standard setting. we've been doing all this research, and like the headroom work, both the development of the approach and then extracting the lessons, is our research findings. What does that, if you kind of take initial findings, here's the research outputs, what does that leave us in terms of the staff recommendations for which things we should still try to pursue, or, you know, what has made us rethink, so that here are our proposed new objectives in terms of what are we trying to solve and what are we not, before we start going into the here's this alternative, that alternative, that, you know, otherwise it's just kind of a package of different things we could do, you know, an accumulation. So I think keeping the discipline of what are the problems we're trying to solve, but using the work we've done so far to assess the original problem identification and update it, so again we know where we're going. That's how I think I'd start thinking about what the shape is, how many alternatives we bring in, how we group them, what interactivity we identify, and how much more work we have to do before we can consult about them.
Now, we did discuss possible disclosure requirements on page 10. How far reaching, this is something that you would like to propose in the DP, or what? And how far reaching are those proposals? They don't really come back in your questions.
I think 29C was directly in response to a request from CMAQ. You know, the reasons for paying a premium that exceeds and the key assumptions or targets and subsequently the actual versus what was assumed. So that we've been exploring all these years directly as a as a request from CMAQ. So that was the first CMAQ meeting after we did the PIR, where they wanted that, and we've been exploring that. And I think what we highlighted in the previous paper is GPF's comments about, you know, confidentiality, and then...
But they don't come back in your recommendations, right? So it's not something that you wished to pursue, or...?
No, these are what we wish to pursue. Yeah, these are what the board decided as, you know, the board wants to pursue these. But I think into the recommendation, what we are saying is our recommendation about ED and the DP. The first one, which is disclosure of headroom, goes into the discussion paper along with the headroom approach. But the other two could go into an ED if you like.
And also the disclosure.
Both B and C. Yeah.
Also.
And there are a few more new disclosure requirements that we've been made aware of, but we haven't still analyzed those. So there are a few things that could potentially get added to that list here.
Perhaps it is good that we just take some questions. And let's start with question 4 on the headroom approach, which is basically a question, do we want to pursue this further as a possible solution? So not just as a piece of analysis, but as a possible solution, either through a request for information or a discussion paper. Can I see who is in favor of doing so?
Sorry, could you restate the question?
So it's question 4.
Yes.
4.
So does the board wish to issue a discussion paper or a request for information to seek feedback on the headroom approach?
Can I clarify? That could be part of this overall paper we're producing, where we would have this in it, or were you thinking about this now as a separate standalone thing?
Well, that was the question here. I mean,
if it's bundled, listen, I think bundled
why
with
I want to
else.
Ask a question, because if there is a majority of the board to pursue this, then we have something that we can pursue.
Okay.
Otherwise, because having listened to the board, I think there is a general recognition that we know better than before that impairment is flawed. Mm-hmm. And that is widely supported by the board. So if that is the case, and we would not pursue 4, if we pursue 4, then we still can tell people we are trying to solve it. Yeah? If we don't pursue 4, we have to think about something else.
I think the reason Daryl's asking the question is, I would vote for covering this analysis in a discussion.
Well, that's what I also said,
not saying I recommend it.
Yeah, that's... So that is, but that is what I think we.
So I think the people who vote on 4 might be saying, do we want to actually put this forward as our solution?
Yeah, as a possible solution. We never know before we do all the work. But is this something we want to go to the market and say, this might be the solution? What do you think? That is the question.
To collect the information,
But not as we have an interesting idea. No, we have an idea that we think could help solve the permit issue. We are thinking seriously about this. What do you think? So not as a free-floating academic question.
Okay. Yeah? So as a more serious question.
Yeah, as a serious question, this is the direction where we want to go.
Yeah.
Who supports that? So that is clearly not enough. And so then we have a situation where we know there is a problem and we don't have a way to fix it at this moment. And, I have no ready answer myself. I've said in my introductory words, it could even be that we in the end conclude, yeah, it is a totally unsatisfactory situation, but there is nothing better. But, I think if we don't want to go ahead with this, we need to think of something else. Mm-hmm. It's very frustrating to take another pause in the discussion here because I'm not sure that we can come up here on the spot with the best way to go forward.
I don't think we should try to do that on the spot here. It seems to me a discussion paper ought to look at the things the board has considered, giving more space to things the board thinks are more realistic alternatives and less to ones that think the board thinks less realistic. I think ideally a discussion paper will have the board's preliminary view on the way forwards. That might be amortization, it might be do something in the headroom, it might be do nothing, whatever the recommendation is. But you get a better response usually, I think, if you have a preference for the board. You get kind of more focused responses. So I think that the subsequent debate is probably going to be about trying to pin down what the board's preliminary view is. I think there's no way we can do that at this meeting.
No.
I think we need to do that, come back to that. And I think, by the way, that if your preliminary view ended up being do nothing, I think that would be a perfectly explicable outcome of your discussions as well, given that there isn't the perfect solution. And then you get feedback on that as well. So it seems to me, thinking about how the mood of the board seems to be, we should be heading for a DP as the next stage. And I think that, personally, I think that's appropriate because I think it's a difficult area. I think stakeholders are going to have different views. They've always had different views on this. They will always have different views on that. So I think giving them the opportunity to look at the full range of issues and giving us input, I think, will put you in a better place for the next stage to figure out what way to go. So what do we need to put a DP together? I think, first of all, we need some raw material. We've got quite a lot of raw material already from your previous discussions. We can work with parts of that, at least, without much more input from you. I think where we'll need input from you...
A lot of raw material and a lot of half-baked material.
Yeah, and our job will be to try and bake it for you. but I think we need input in a couple of areas. First of all, I think there might be specific things where we probably haven't got enough raw material yet. So on the disclosure front, I suspect we probably need to think about that a bit more, and there might need to be a bit more to come in. And secondly, we certainly need to come back at least to reconfirm what your preliminary views are, and probably in some areas to actually identify what the preliminary views are. I like Mary's suggestion of the best way of sort of articulating this. I think maybe the next step would be for us to come back with a kind of project plan for what to do next, which would be to think about what might go into a DP, where we think we need more information, and what we do about areas where we think we need more input from you before we can start writing.
But shouldn't we first agree what really the problem is?
Yes.
We have a board agrees what the problem we want to solve. Otherwise, we will be discussing again different things.
And I thought Mary actually gave us quite a good framework for how to think about that. And I was going to suggest that maybe we do that as the next stage, put together an analysis along the lines Mary suggested, and see if we can agree what the kind of problem statement is.
So what we heard from the PIR.
What we've done... as a follow-up to that,
we have not been able to solve the two outcomes of the PIR, which was too little too late and too costly.
But we identified, I think, five. So let's remember what the others are.
These are at least, and I think that is something those are things that we have to solve at least one of those two. I also think we should look more seriously at disclosures.
I mean, if it helps, of the five that we identified, one is too little too late, the second one is too costly, the third one was subsequent accounting for goodwill. So the board tentatively decided not to consider reintroducing amortization, at least at the December meeting.
Well, that is, of course, part
at the December
little,
meeting.
Too little,
so, yeah.
Too late.
The fourth one was about allowing some identifiable intangibles to be included within goodwill. Even that was decided. The board decided not to consider allowing more intangibles to be included within goodwill. And the fifth one is disclosures.
Françoise made one comment which stuck in my mind, which is that she said, well, if you think there's a reputational risk, then to take something on that you know is going to take six years to complete, perhaps not completely convincing.
So can I talk to that, Hans, because I picked up that point as well. Is there, as we talk about having DP, we feel the years stretching out. Is it possible to address some of these concerns in the two places we've mentioned, which is principles of disclosure, the disclosure initiative and primary financial statements. So within primary financial statements, is it possible for us to consider the presentation of goodwill? That's one thing. And then in disclosure initiative, Françoise had mentioned whether we might consider IAS 36 and IFRS 3 as candidates for the testing of our new disclosure initiative approach. And as part of that testing process, that would give us the chance to reconsider the disclosures in those two standards. So my question is there a way that we can address the timeliness that we're worried about?
We need to put them into a different project to escalate them. Because if we thought they were developed enough to go straight to an ED, I think we could do that in this project.
Well, first of all, I was going to say two things about Françoise's comments, which were very good. I think, first of all, if the fact that the board realizes we have a problem and makes that public is, of course, already a signal to the market. We know that there is something going on that we are not entirely happy about, and protects us a little bit. But perhaps it's a very crude, simple proposal that I made about this presentation of goodwill, but that is at least something that might be easy to do and quick to do. If we do it in primary financial statements, I don't know if we're going in the DP route or as well.
Yes.
So let's think about that. If there's an easy solution as a sort of a holding measure, beware, there might be a problem here. Pay special attention, and then we can continue our work.
I mean, I think there's another element of reputational risk as well, which is the danger of rushing too quickly into an area where views are always very polarised. And I remember vividly the debates in the 90s about goodwill when there were three or four different treatments that were used internationally, sometimes in the same jurisdiction.
Yeah.
And every single group thought that all the other groups had an unfair advantage, I mean, every single one. So so there's no guarantee that if you move to a different place in 5 years' time, let's say, that you won't regret it in 10 years' time.
Yeah. No, that is true. Françoise?
Well, my comment at this stage was that if the updated MIM approach is out of the table, why are we going to DP? I mean, if the question is, if the choice is between the statu quo with the flows that we know, or the amortization, which is not a model that we need to investigate. I mean, basically, we have to take bets on whether it's 10 years, 15, 20, or whatever, and basically you're done. And you still have the impairment model as it is to help on top of that. Why do we need a DP? We have the evidence from the post-implementation review as to where the difficulties lie. Why would we absolutely want that an ED is exactly what we're going to print as the standard? It's a consultation step out of which eventually our preliminary review won't be the final decision we make. Why is that a problem?
Well, I think the function of this DP could... We, as a board here, have at least formed some consensus about that the what we see, the malfunctioning of the flaw, the serious flaws in the impairment process as we have it now in the standard. I think there are a lot of people out there who will not immediately agree with that. And I think that in the DP we can sketch all the discoveries that we did through the good work of the staff and ask people, do you agree that there is a problem? And I would imagine that a lot more people will say, yes, they're not, having seen this analysis, we agree there is a problem. And then the question of what is the alternative, should we go for an alternative, becomes a more serious question. So I think that is that will be a very important function of a discussion here.
If I may, I mean, if we go to a DP, then why wouldn't the updated ADEME approach be one of the possibilities? Because, I mean, you identify the flaw, and you have either a solution to that flaw, or you have eventually amortization with all the advantages that you mentioned about it. But, I mean, why would we? I mean, if we have the cost and time involved in seeking input, why would we decide that a possible solution is just no longer on the table when I don't know, a number of months before we had a majority in favor of it?
That's not what I voted for. What I voted, I didn't, which is why I tried to clarify the question before we called it, because I think if we did a DP, I would assume we would cover the headroom approach in there, talk about why we had developed it, how we think it works, etc. The only difference is to you, I think, is I wouldn't be saying, and Sue Lloyd thinks this is the good solution to it. I wouldn't be put it forward as my preference, but I'd still put the analysis in there and ask for feedback on it.
Yeah, I think the clearest way to write a DP is to come up with what the board's preliminary view is, but then discuss what the alternatives are, and then find a way to seek feedback from people, but not having a kind of scattergun approach, but have kind of focus.
I think at this moment we would have no idea what the preliminary view of the board would be. So I think the staff needs to do work and put the possibilities on the table, and then we can discuss it. Not even of my own. Yeah. Daryl?
So just to add to Peter's summary, I think, of what came out of the meeting, I think the idea of starting with the problem statement, what is the problem that's been identified, I think makes a lot of sense. It's something to bring back for the board to look at. Over and above the five issues that we identified as part of the PIR, I think we should perhaps at least add the one that Hans mentioned at the beginning, which is the inconsistency between acquisition accounting balance sheet and organic balance sheet. Now, I don't think that came up, but I think that's one that a lot of people talk about, and I think it comes back to issues like the one Tuck was raising, that the significant difference in balance sheets throws out how people analyze if they're using machine analysis and other things. So I think adding that as a sixth one is important. And then it seems to me that it might be the other thing that's come out of the discussion we've had here is this idea that depending on the starting point of our analysis, some or all of these solutions play a different role in it. So essentially we've ended up with a bunch of tools, deliberately or not. In part, that's because we've taken this as a let's solve individually the problems that have been identified through the PIR. But I think starting with, if you like, four headings, and the one heading would be the approach we've taken, individually solving the PIR. A second approach might be solving, if we were to think about wanting to achieve a common balance sheet, which of these solutions do we need to have? So kind of taking the solutions into the different items so that we can understand. I think even a DP might work like that. So if we're thinking about a piecemeal, if we're thinking about direct responses to the PIR, we have a section of the DP that says, well, these are the direct solutions we're suggesting. If, on the other hand, we're thinking about having the perfect impairment non-amortization model, then actually some of the things like headroom become a lot more palatable, because we're saying, actually, we don't really buy the story about it being too much effort. And so we think that we want the best model, and this is what the best model looks like. If we think that all we are trying to resolve is to give users more information about the success of acquisitions, then a disclosure-only solution might actually be what we're looking for. But I think mapping it out like that might just help us think about what the different solutions are that are available to us. And perhaps when we publish this in the DP, it might also help you, the constituents actually think about it in those different channels.
Can I just comment on that point about organic versus acquisition? Because
it's a huge project.
Because I think that's one thing, if we say that's one fact we might look at when we're evaluating alternatives. I think to actually examine that from scratch is a very big scope of extension.
It's not going to help our timeliness problem.
Yeah.
In fact,
That might encourage two different streams, one which is a longer-term stream and one which is disclosure, get it done now.
But in some way, we've partly explored that in the intangibles paper as well, because one of the list of five or six approaches that we said we're not recommending exactly includes one of the approaches that would take away the difference between an organically growing company versus an inorganically growing company. In fact, we also have one of the options for subsequent accounting for goodwill as direct write-off of goodwill, which the board rejected as an idea. So we had ideas in there which would remove the difference between the two balance sheets, but were effectively rejected already in the past.
In some ways, the solution, though, that we've talked about around the table, which is, for example, the presentational difference where I would show equity before and after, is one way of solving this problem without taking something off the balance sheet. So there's not only one solution to the problem.
Mary?
Couple things. If you talk about trying to update what the originally identified follow-up points from the PIR are, you know, Raghava, when you recited them, don't do it again. you stated them as if they were all kind of biblical truths. And I think one of the things that we might find, you know, from the work we've done is that our conclusions about one or two of them may be, having done this research, we conclude it might be that we are not going to address it, but sometimes it may be that it is not actually a problem. And the one that I think of particularly is the, you know, impairment too costly. Well, if what you're trying to cope with is the view that the acquisition gets so integrated into existing operations, and you're testing the recoverability of a pool of costs rather than a specific item, the answer may be, apart from a couple of very minor tunings, you know, that you've identified, it's not too costly because that is the consequences of those other decisions. So it may be that the analysis not only decides that we aren't going to address things, but we've learned things about it that disproves the initial RF, you know, the initial PIR finding. So think about that too. And then back, I just wanted to echo in a different way what Francoise was saying about headroom. I did not vote for, you know, I question four to say, let's pursue it, because putting my idealism aside, I think Hans is realistic about the chances of being successful going out and taking this as our answer, our headline answer to this. But I really think we should not bury it and never look at it again, and we should get feedback, because I think we have to start the section of the paper, as I said, with what did we learn from that, and then give a pretty complete overview of what the headroom approach was and ultimately what the initial feedback was that led, you know, that caused us to say we're not going to pursue this as the primary response. So that if people, you know, have a different view as they work through it and understand better what we've learned about the shortfalls of impairment, we don't have to start again. My vote on that question, much as I think that there is still intellectually attraction in the headroom approach, is that it would end up delaying something that's going to be long, even longer in the end, because people would only come around to it as if they rejected it, we did other things, and then we came back to it. So I thought better to not spend the first period, but I think it has to be not just included as see these papers where we discussed it, but give it fair time, the way Hans talked about in his introductory remarks, discussing some of the alternatives that we'd rejected in other areas, so that if people wanted to call them out, they were pointing to a specific thing rather than a broad concept.
Okay, and Françoise, and let's then not come to a conclusion.
Like others, I think it's really important how we structure the content of the DP and what we put in, because some of the negative feedback we've had on the headroom approach has been from people who thought if they're, well, I'm speculating, if they're negative enough, then we won't do it. But if the idea is a choice between a total write-off of goodwill on day one versus...
That's true.
If we decided tomorrow and action tomorrow, a total write-off of goodwill on acquisition, I think it'd have economic effects. So I think it matters how we present the things. And it's not headroom versus nothing. It's headroom whether, oh, would you like it all written off on day one? I think we get a different reaction.
Those are the choices
you would. No, without advocating that we would have this work done in different projects, I think it would be valuable to benefit in this project regarding disclosures from the work we've been doing, we are doing right now on the disclosure initiative, because if we are, I mean, out of all the outreach that has already been had with users, if we were in the capacity of formulating these specific objectives that we discussed this morning and seeing whether the current disclosure requirements are sufficient or not in order to indeed help meeting those objectives, I think we would clearly see, demonstrate, in fact, where more disclosures are needed and what they could be. So I think it would help us in being very effective and very convincing in whatever supplementary disclosure we are offering.
Okay. Peter,
So we ought to summarise what we've heard, and then we've got, I think, one other specific question which we did want to follow up because you've got it in the papers here, which is question one, but maybe we should attempt the sum up of this part of the discussion. So I think what we're hearing from the board is you'd like us to work towards a discussion paper as the document. I don't know whether we should actually take a formal vote on that, but that certainly seems, do you think we should?
Yeah, I was actually going to suggest maybe another way to think about this is just to put the whole DPED question on hold until we come back with the alternatives, because it could be that it becomes so clear that some of this discussion that we're thinking about putting into a DP may fit just as well into a basis for conclusions.
If we could think of a request for views type of document.
Mm-hmm. All I'm wondering is if we just put that question on hold instead of committing to it right now.
So in which case, I think what we're going to do is bring back an analysis for the next discussion of how we will go about developing a DP, what further things we think we still need to discuss with you. I think we would include in that analysis the analysis suggested by Mary, which is looking at the original objective set up in the PIR, what we've learned from the research we've done so far, and what that leaves us as recommendations for the next steps in terms of issues to consider and the sorts of things to put into the DP. Perhaps also at that stage some sort of at least high-level kinds of things we might have in the DP. I think it'd be, shouldn't go beyond that, but we should maybe try and include that next time as well. You know, chapter headings or something like that, perhaps. Just some sort of high-level structure. Does that make sense?
Okay, we thank the staff for their patience.
Well, but we might exhaust your patience, which is question one. Rather, do you want to just call that one, maybe?
Before you call it, if you want to call it, I think we need actual discussion of some of the proposals in there. And I'm not, maybe today, maybe not today, but let's not push a vote without doing the discussion, because to me, the whole point of saying, we've taken the vote and agreed that we're going to propose removing the prohibition on including future restructurings. But the manner in which we do it, including the measurement of the cash flows in particular, whether it's probable that you'll take that action, to then jump to the most the single most likely set of cash flows, when these are future events with high degree of variability, particularly on the return, and not talking about the uncertainty and what information investors need, I think is a pretty big leap. And I think I, before I can decide that that's the approach I would support, I would want to see a bit more analysis and consideration of the different approaches and what the pros and cons may be, because in other recent situations when we've been faced with measuring something that has a lot of uncertainty, we have not gone for the single most likely outcome. And I kind of wondered why. You don't have to answer that now unless you're going to try and make me vote one way or another.
I think I can answer to that question, because I think one of the difficulties we had from past discussions at the board was, because the board's budgets are the starting point for estimating future cash flows, I think there was this concern that requiring an expected value approach to, you know, to measuring the cash flows from future restructuring would be costly enough to take away any benefit of removing that as you know, as a restriction. And in fact, the existing basis for IAS 36 also acknowledges that in some way management's budgets are single point estimates. So that's the reason IAS 36 allows expected value approach as one of the options of projecting future cash flows rather than requiring an expected value technique.
Yeah, but we also surfaced in our discussions around this area the fact that budgeting can range from the best estimate of what's going to happen to stretch goals and targets. And if you have, you know, the restructuring measurement incorporating the most optimistic, I wonder in particular about the validity of that and how it then cycles into actually increasing, in particular, the in particular some of the complexity of the goodwill calculation, you know, the impairment calculation, and whether we'll have consistency or inconsistency in the, it would be for IAS 36. I feel like we're going down a route that's very different, and I see your point about IAS 36 being built on budgets, and that's helpful, helpful to understand that as the starting premise, but I think it's going to give us a very flaky number, and that's very subject to manipulation.
The risk of giving us draft words is always that we then pick on drafting, so you suffer the consequences of your own actions. I wasn't sure when I read the draft wording, and I know that it's just a first bash, whether or not the emphasis should be on whether the expected future cash inflows and outflows are more likely than not to occur, or whether it's the restructuring that's more likely or not to occur. So I might be certain that I'm going to restructure, but then there may be a range of cash flows that might arise, and I thought it was the cash flows rather than the event that was more likely than not that I was expecting, but maybe something to think about.
Constanza?
Well, I had come to this meeting thinking that we would benefit from a request for views at the time.
Yeah.
A request for information, sorry. That we would eventually seek input on the question that has kept coming as a comment in almost every paper on this. That was, the use of budget is being criticized because it would be challenges rather than realistic forecast, and as a result, should not be relied upon. But I think we need to raise that question in our next consultation, because when you have a requirement that asks you to base cash flow projection on a realistic forecast, and to do that on the basis of budgets, if there are doubts as to whether a budget is a realistic forecast, you just can't comply. So I think we need to clean our thinking around this issue. Either it's realistic forecast, and a budget qualifies as such, or it's a realistic forecast and the budget doesn't qualify, or we don't want a budget qualifying, or we prioritize the elements. You can use your budget as long as it is a realistic forecast. But I don't think we can go on suspecting that the basis on which we require something is just not sound. So that was. So I'm not ready to say yes. I mean, the only thing that we have to address is the one that you propose. I think this one has to be straightened out as well. The other point I wanted to make is that I'm in fact on the same line as you on the issue of, I mean, the event to me is certain. It's also one or zero whether I decide that I'm going to do that. So I put it in my budget when I decide I'm going to do it. But indeed, I may have uncertainties as to exactly the cost of it, and there I can make a number of assumptions. Exactly as when I'm going to make my budgets for my sales, for example, I'm not going to say that I'm going to win each and every possible market, possible contract that I have in my forecast. I'm going to give different weights to where I think I have more chances to be successful or not successful.
Gary?
Thank you. And, actually support the staff's recommendation on question one. I mean, reality is detailed budgets don't go out very far in big companies, but yet the impairment calculation has to go out perhaps decades. So you're sort of running, you know, most of your projections is based on reasonable projections based on good faith estimates. And this is just restructuring costs and savings is just another discretionary spending, no different than a lot of other discretionary spending that would routinely be in your impairment calculation, whether it's consistent gross margin or consistent profit before tax. I mean, most of your revenues don't exist or not even necessarily under contract for long-term impairment recovery. So this is just another estimate that goes into the model, and almost the entire model is an estimate. You know, and maybe the current year and the next year get a detailed budget, and it very quickly falls off after that. So why would we discriminate against this one than any other discretionary cost that's on it? So for those reasons, and, as well as what's in the paper, I support you.
I'm out.
Thanks, Hans. I agree with the idea, but the problem to me is the wording. So when I started reading, changing best estimate for realistic forecast, I don't know what's that. What is realistic? So even Gary, when he was expressing, he mentioned estimates three times. So it's apparently what we have today might work. So really, we should pay particular attention to wording here. And it goes to 33B, as suggested. I think it's still, I agree with Mary, we are probably landing in a very different position compared to what we have today. Because, for instance, if the management has any plans, so any to me can be, yes, I think, to, yes, I'm almost certain that I will do that. So very attention to the wording and how we are going to phrase that.
And Chao?
Thank you, Hans. Yes, I also have some wording concern or clarification. I agree with Marlo's concern about any plans, whether it's open too broad space for it. Another concern about we were expected future cash inflows and outflows from those plans. Suppose the entity are going to enhance assets and the performance will be included in the future. So at the first day, maybe the first year, outflow will incur first. And the performance will be improved in the future. So the future cash flow in will be in the future. So how to measure that? And secondly, I also want to know this notion and how can, because currently IS-16, we did mention the accounting treatments for the future, you know, for the enhancement of the PPE's future, you know, performance. And if the company incurs some subsequent cost, and that cost could improve the PPE's future performance, those outflow will be included in the carrying amount of the assets, not the value in use. That's the benefit outflow you can gain. So I'm thinking that because we are comparing the value in use or carrying the recoverable amount and the carrying amount of the CGU, which goodwill allocated in, and this CGU, this assets, performance will be improved in the future. So the cost actually should be included in the carrying amount of these assets. And then we compare this carrying amount to the future cash flow and whether these assets impaired or not, because the assets have been improved, not the original assets. This is the improved assets. So I'm saying, yeah, so there's some, it seems there's some inconsistency with this approach to the requirements as set out at IS-16.
Okay, well, the staff have heard some suggestions about the wording, I suppose. Having heard that, can we support the staff's recommendation? Or is it impossible? I ask a question.
Question one.
Yeah.
Yes.
Three, four, six.
So, another failure.
Now, I was reading it. I mean, I still support that direction.
Right.
Whether I support the exact wording is something else.
Okay.
I support the direction.
Okay, again.
Direction.
Okay, all right. Direction helps.
13.
Oh, look at that.